start out talking a little bit about the four mitzvot that we're obligated to keep on Purim and sort of use that as a stepping stone for what we're going to be talking about this morning. So if you look on your first, on the source sheet, on the first page, right, we see the four mitzvot as brought down from the Gemara in the Shulchan Aruch. And we know that if we see Chayav Adam, right, Chayav Kol Adam, Litein Lefachot, Shtei Matanot, Shtei Aniyim, Chayav Adam L'Shoch L'Chaveiro, Shnei Batanot, Basar Oshel, right, Minei Ochlim, we see that there are four mitzvot, and it goes on, and it talks about the issue of Seudah B'Purim, and it talks about the issue of Mikra Megillah. Right, the four mitzvot say that a Jew is obligated to fulfill both man and woman on the holiday of Purim. Right? And so I wanted to ask a couple of questions this morning to sort of start us off. Something that struck me as interesting about these four mitzvot that we're obligated to keep. Right? First thing is, if we look at the mitzvot, three of the four mitzvot, right? If you look at the second source on the page, three of the four mitzvot that we have are taken from the Megillah itself. If you look at the end of Perek Tet, Pasuk Chaf Bet talks about, it says, Kayamim asher nachu bahem hayehudim me'oyveihem, ve'achodesh asher nehapach lahem miyagol mesimcha ume'eivel yom tov, lasot otam yimei mishteh v'simcha, mishloach manot ishoyeyu u'matanot le'evyonim. Right? The three out of the four mitzvot that we keep are actually pulled from the Megillah itself, and they were sort of these celebrations, the parties that the Jews made after they had been saved from Haman and from all of their enemies throughout the Persian Empire. And something you might ask, right? So we think about all the other holidays throughout the year. There's something strange about these mitzvot, and by strange, I don't mean anything inherently strange with them, but there's something about them that doesn't really fit in with the rubric that we see with all the other mitzvot, commemorative mitzvot throughout the year. Other commemorative mitzvot, if you think about it, right, are sort of commemorative mitzvot that are intended to almost conjure up the experience, right, that was the process that led to that sort of pivotal moment that became the impetus for the holiday, right? So for example, on Pesach, right, so we eat matzah to remember it's the lechem oni, we remember the slavery, and we remember the rush that the Jews were in at the night of the Exodus, right? Lighting the menorah on Hanukkah. Lighting the menorah on Hanukkah isn't celebrating only the miracle. Lighting the menorah on Hanukkah is a commemoration, right, of the loyalty that the Maccabim had to sort of uphold these very stringent standards of Tuma and Tahara, even at a time when the entire country, let alone the Beit HaMikdash, had been completely defiled. Right? And so the other commemorative mitzvot are on some level to sort of conjure up that experience of that process. What is it that led to the holiday itself? Right? And if we think about it, these three mitzvot that we have on Purim are a little different. They're not necessarily experiences that led up to the holiday, right? You might say, if I were going to throw out to you and ask you, well, what should be a mitzvah so we could commemorate the experience of Purim, you would say, you know, have an effigy of Haman. You might say, and as silly as it sounds, right, you might say, well, have a mock beauty contest, right? So women can experience the fear and the anxiety that Esther must have felt when here was this young Jewish girl who was going to be kidnapped and basically locked away in a harem for the rest of her life. So as silly as it sounds, those would have been things that would help us experience what the Jews in Persia experienced and what the reason, sort of the impetus again for the holiday. Instead, what we have are sort of a throwback to the parties that they celebrated after everything was over. Right? And we would imagine after Yom Suf, and we would imagine definitely after the Jews had defeated the Greeks, right, in the first century CE, that, you know, excuse me, BCE, that there was, you know, parties also. But that's not what we celebrate on the holiday, right? What we celebrate are the mitzvot, or the commemoration of the experience leading up to the holiday. And that's my first question. Second question is, if we look again at all the other days throughout the year, right, every Shabbat and Yom Tov, we know that there's a part of Torah, or a part of Tanakh, and or, which we are mandated to read, and it becomes part of the liturgy of the day. Purim is the only day in which we are not just, it's not just suggested, it's not just a part of the liturgy of the day. We must read from this portion of Tanakh, right? And if you do not read Megillat Esther, if you do not hear Mikra Megillah on Purim, you did not fulfill your requirement of the day. Right? Why is that? Why is Purim sort of in a category of its own when it comes to this portion of Tanakh? I think that the answer really is going to lie in the unique way in which Megillah is written, and which we're going to talk about today. So just by way of example, if we can look at the first example, if we look at the first parak, the opening scene, right, for the entire Megillah, we're going to have this book that's written about the Jewish experience in the first real exile, right, the Jews in Persia, 5th century BCE, right? And we're going to hear about the plot of their enemies to kill them and how they ultimately were saved from this evil decree, right? And if we look at the opening scene to this very crucial book of Tanakh, we're struck by two things. First thing I think that we're struck by is sort of the elaborate description of this palace in which the story takes place, right? So by way of contrast, right, if we think of any other book in Tanakh, think of Megillat Rut. Right? How does Megillat Rut begin? Vayihi bimei shvod ha-shoftim, vayira av ba'aretz. Very simply, the tkufa, and one major thing maybe possibly to give us the setting. Right? The Megillat Rut in Rut does not begin, and the fields were so fallow, and describing how hungry the children were, and describing how, you know, how there was nothing to eat. That's it. We're told shvod ha-shoftim, and we're told ra'av ba'aretz. Megillat Esther is really the only book in which we're given such an elaborate description and detailed description. We're going to see when we look in, if you look inside, right? Talks about Achashverosh, who is Melech Mehodu v'yad Kush, Sheva v'esrimu me'yam medina. And the Pasuk, the Megillah is using superlatives. If you look in Pasuk Gimel, right? Lechol ebishnat shalosh l'malko asam ishte lechol starav avadav, chel parasu madai hafartimim v'sarei hamedinot l'fanav, right? Making it for all the princes of his empire. V'haroto et osher kvod malchuto v'etiv kartif eret gedulato. Speaking of the extravagance and the opulence that was the Persian Empire, and we know, by the way, this to be true historically, the Greeks that write later on, sort of in retrospect about the Persians, mock them for this sort of conspicuous consumption that was so that the Persians were so famous for. And yet it was beautiful nonetheless. And so we're struck by the very detailed description. If you read on, we're told what the floors were made of and what the columns were made of and the couches and the drinking goblets. And it's somewhat, again, strange based on what we're used to from the Torah or from Tanakh, right? The only other time where we really have detailed descriptions of a physical structure like this is the Mishkan, right, exactly, and the Beit HaMikdash. But in that case, the reason we have those detailed descriptions is because the Beit HaMikdash and Mishkan themselves are central to the narrative. And we needed to know what they looked like, and we needed to know exactly how they were built and exactly what materials were used to build them. Okay, in those cases, it's central to the narrative. Here what we have, which is unique for Tanakh, is such, a detailed description just setting it up for us, just giving us the background, right? We don't have this anywhere else. Okay? A second thing that strikes us as strange is this sort of overuse almost, or something we're sort of caught off guard with, is the use of these Persian terms, right? If you look inside, Persian names, we have Persian words, we have Persian phrases. Look, if you look inside, it's talking about Chol Sarav back in Pasuk Gimel. It says, Chol Sarav Avadav, Chel Parasu Madai Hafartimim. Right? What's Hafartimim? Hafartimim is not a Hebrew word. And many of these words that are sort of, any word that you come across that you find very difficult to pronounce or you're not really sure what it means, assume it's a word that's really transliterated from Persian. Right? So you can use the Mefarshim to try to understand what they mean, or we can, today, you know, we have modern scholarship that really tries to look at the etymology of the word from Persian, potentially from Babylonian as well. But, you know, again, unique to Megillat Esther, there's really very few other Svarim. Daniel's really the only other one, where we're so inundated with this foreign language, with jargon, with lingo that we're totally unfamiliar with. A third question, we're going to see really the questions begin to answer themselves. Third question I want to throw out is less on the text itself and more our reaction to the text. Right? We know that at this period, 5th century BCE, we're dealing with the Jews in Persia, but there was also a parallel community in Eretz Israel. Right? The Jews that had gone back with Zerubbabel, once Koresh had made his decree, the Jews had gone back and started to try to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. And if we look in source 4, we have description of what was going on for the Jews at that time. It says, Vayihi am ha'aret merapim yidei am Yehuda umevahalim umevahalim otam livnot v'sokrim alehem yoatzim lahafer atatam kol yimei koresh melech paras v'ad malchut zaryavesh melech paras. Right, talking about the difficulties that the Jews went through when they were trying to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. They had all these, the nations that basically either surrounded Eretz Israel or the nations that had been brought in while the Israel were out of the country, some of them even as early as 720 BCE. Right? And these other nations that were living there were basically trying to thwart the efforts of the Jews. And so every time the Jews were trying to make headway with building the Beit HaMikdash, they were set back. And if you look, Nehemiah really describes it, I think, very poignantly. The Jews in Eretz Yisrael were screaming to their brothers, to their brethren, we might imagine in Persia or in any of the other countries that were under the Persian regime. Talking about how hungry they were, how they literally had no money to feed their children. And, you know, again, in the interest of time, we're not going to read through it all today, but if you look further in this parak in Nehemiah, it talks about the Jews actually selling their own children into slavery. They didn't have a choice. Okay? And so we have this community in Israel who's literally suffering, right? And again, a question that we can ask on our reaction, we read this first perek, if I threw out to you and I said, in Europe in 1941, there's not anyone in the room who wouldn't automatically think of the Jews in Europe, the Jews in Poland, the Jews in Hungary, Czechoslovakia. And yet we read this first sentence, and I don't think any of us really even give a second thought to the Jews in Eretz Israel. As I said, I think that the first two questions really answer this question and speaks to what we're going to be talking about today. The Megillah is written in a very unique way. When we read Megillat Esther, if we really pay attention, right, we're not just being told a story. Megillat Esther is written in a way that it elicits from us a very, very powerful response. And what we're going to see is that our experience as the readers, when we're reading the Megillah, mirrors almost exactly the experience of the people in this world of the Megillah, the experience of the people on the page. So for example, what we see is we see here, and we read Vayhi Bimei Achashverosh, and we say, well, why aren't we worried about the Jews in Israel? Well, we're not worried because the next thing that strikes us before we even have a minute to think about the Jews in Eretz Israel is Dov Achashverosh Hamuleich Mehodu V'yad Kush. Right? We're caught up in the power, in the vastness that is this Persian Empire. And we know that at the height of the Persian Empire, it really was the greatest empire the world had ever seen up until that point. Achashverosh really, if we, you know, depending on which king it is, ruled almost the entire known world. Okay? And so we don't have time to think about the Jews in Eretz Yisrael because we're suddenly struck by the power and the vastness. And then we're taken, literally, on this visual tour of the palace, of the epicenter of all this power. Right? If we look inside, Pasuk Gimel, Bishnat shalosh marko asamishtel lechol sarav avadav chel parasu magai hafartimim v'sarei hametinot lefanav. And we talk, if we skip down to Pasuk Hey, right? Ubim la'ot hayamim ha'ele. Once those days were over, asa ha'melech v'chol ha'am ha'nimtzaim v'shushan ha'birah v'migadol v'ad katan mishte shivat yamim b'chatzar ginat bitan ha'melech. We're given this sort of general setting, and then we're taken in to this world. Chur karpas utechilet achuz v'chavlei butz v'argaman al gvilei chesef v'amudei sheish mitot zahav v'chasef al v'tpat v'hat v'sheish v'dar v'socharet. We are given a description, floor to ceiling, right? What we're looking at. And we're almost caught up in the allure of this, the marble and the gold and the silver and the tapestries. And there's not an inch of this palace that isn't being described for us, right? And so we walk in and we're literally drawn into this world of wealth and of extravagance and of luxury. And again, the drinking, the golden drinking goblets and the types of wine and the religious freedom. If we look down in Pasuk Chet, the Hashtiyah Hidat Enones, Kichem Yisad HaMelech, Al Kol Ruach Beitola, So Kirton Ish Va'ish. This, we're fantasizing about this world where everyone can do whatever they want amidst all this wealth and luxury, right? And so again, if you think about it, right, we, much like the Jews of Persia, right, are experiencing what, and again, everything we're going to be talking about today, you know, we know that Megillat Esther is the quintessential book of Galut. And so everything that we're going to see in Megillat Esther is really, the experience of the Jews in Persia is really just the prototype for everything that we're going to see sort of, you know, as almost a cycle, right, this sort of cyclical thing that happens throughout the next 2,500 years of Galut. And there are nuanced differences, clearly, because we're in different parts of the world, in different countries. But for the most part, this is a prototype for everything Jews will experience from here on in. Right? And so we, much like the Jews of Persia, right, and much like the Jews in any sort of new empire, under any new regime, are caught up in this newness, right, in this sort of the promise and the allure and all the things that this new empire has to offer, right? At the same time, right, we're also a little caught off guard, and we're also a little thrown off because, okay, we're drawn in and we want to experience it, and yet, hold on a second, what are fartamim, right? And if we look down at Pasuk Yud, right, Biyom Hashvi Ketov Leiv Hamalach Bayayin Amar Lemehuman Bizatah Harbona Bigtava Avanta Zeitar VeKarkas, right? These names of people that the Megillah is throwing at us, they're not even primary characters. We're not going to see most of them ever again. And yet the Megillah is throwing these names at us that we could barely pronounce, right, as a way of sort of throwing us off. right? We feel like we want to be a part of this world, and at the same time, we're trying to figure this world out. What exactly are Fartanim? What exactly do these officers do? And how do we pronounce these words in this other language? Right? And so we're having sort of that dual experience, wanting to be a part of it, being drawn in to the allure that is this new world, and at the same time being sort of thrown off and being confused. Right? If you look at the words in Pasuk Vav, the end of that Pasuk describing all the materials that were used, says, Al Nispan, Bahat Vashesh Vidar Vesocharet. Those three words, Bahat Vidar Vesocharet, never appear again in Tanakh. Right? They're words that are strictly used in the Gilat Esther. And so again, we're trying to imagine this palace, and yet we can't even imagine it fully because here are materials that we've never heard of that are unique to this Persian palace. Okay? And so we have that sort of dual experience, and I think very much what the Megillah is sort of doing for us is allowing us to experience what the Jews in Persia were experiencing at this point. Okay? We're going to see other examples of this if we look down in Perek Dalet. Okay? Perek Dalet is basically sort of it's the climax, really, of the Megillah. It's definitely, I would say, a very crucial point of transformation for Esther Hamalka. And up until now, and again, you can look at home and sort of, you can verify what I'm saying, but if you look, the Megillah keeps a very, sort of the tempo of the Megillah up until now, up until Perek Dalet, has been a very, very quick pace. Right, sort of the momentum is kept up, and we're sort of moving from one thing to the next, and any insignificant details are just left out. We're not given details about things that will interfere with the pace getting us to the point we want to get to. Right? For example, if you look at Pasuk Aleph, it says, Mordechai yadat kol asher na'asa. Right? Mordechai knew everything that happened. Right? This clandestine meeting happened between Haman and Ahasuerus. Next Pasuk tells us Mordechai knew. Doesn't stop and slow down to tell us how Mordechai knew. Where was Mordechai getting this information? Was Mordechai's information true or not true? Because that's not the point. We're trying to get to the main point. Right? And that's really how the Megillah was working until now. But if we read a little bit further, right, and we see that Mordechai puts on tzitzit ve'efer, and then this correspondence between him and Esther begins, right? If you look inside, Pasuk Hey, right, the Na'arotz come and tell Esther that Mordechai is standing outside in tzitzit ve'efer, which we know is against the law. He's not allowed to come into the gate wearing tzitzit ve'efer. And it says, Vatikra Esther lahatrach misarisei ha'melech asher he'emid lefaneha, Vatitzavehu al Mordechai ladat mazeh ve'al mazeh. Esther sends out to find out what's going on, what's Mordechai doing. Vayetze hatach el Mordechai el rechov ha'ir asher lifnei shar ha'melech. Right? And now we're given from, this Megillah that was giving us the bare essentials, just what we needed to know for the story. Suddenly, we're giving these details about where Hatach was leaving from, the street that he was going out into, in front of Shar HaMelech, right? And then in Pasuk Zayin, Mordechai explains to him everything that happened, Pasukim Zayin and Chet. Pasuk Tet, Vayavo Hatach, Vayagid Esther, Et Divrei Mordechai, Vatomer Esther LaHatach, Vatitzaveihu El Mordechai. And here, from this pace that was sort of keeping up this momentum until now, suddenly we're slowed down to almost a snail's pace, wasting psukim, or what seems to be wasting psukim, on describing where Hatach was leaving from and where he was going to, and the way back from Mordechai back into Esther, right? And it sort of does not fit at all with what we've been seeing until now. But if you think about it, right, you could argue that this is really, I think, a big part of it, is sort of to give us a sense of the spatial distance between Esther and Mordechai. Right? We imagine that things were so easy for them to have conversations, and really what we get a sense of with this constant back and forth is Esther being cloistered away in this palace where she was a wife, and yet she was really a prisoner because she couldn't leave to go out and speak to Mordechai, and Mordechai in this sort of stance of passive resistance right outside the gate trying to make his point heard. Right? And so you could say it's sort of to describe the, cumbersome, sort of the difficulty that it was for Mordechai and Esther to have this conversation. But I think that, again, it speaks to something else, and I think it speaks to what the Megillah wants us to experience. Right? Again, not limited to Persia. If you think any time in Jewish history where the Jews are waiting on verdict, waiting on sort of the outcome of a decision that's going to have very, very real and very immediate ramifications and consequences for them, time almost slows down. Right? Think about any point in Jewish history. Think about Jews in the Middle Ages. They know that there's a debate going on with the church in the center of town, and they're waiting to hear the outcome. Right? And it's as if when you're waiting for that outcome, time literally slows down, or time almost stops, because you know that whatever answer that comes out of that place is going to determine so much for you and for your family and for the community. Right? Think about, anytime, Jews in Russia, right, living under the Tsar, and one Tsar dies, and they're waiting to hear who's the next one that's going to take over. Is he going to be better or worse? Are there going to be more pogroms, or are there going to be less pogroms? Right? So too with Mordechai and Esther. Mordechai is begging. Mordechai wants nothing more than for Esther to say she's going to go in and save the Jews. And Esther wants nothing more from Mordechai, and we're going to see this in a couple of minutes, you know, an affirmation that things will be fine and she will be okay, right? And God will protect her. And we're going to see that sort of the waiting and the experience that Mordechai and Esther are experiencing is something that the Megillah almost compels us to feel. By slowing us down and having all these psukim in between, right? Lifnei Sha'ar HaMelech, Vayavo HaTach, Vayaged Esther, the reader, we ourselves, like Mordechai and Esther, are forced to slow down, right? We're forced to sort of dwell on this experience that was such a grueling experience, an experience that really, even though in reality it didn't take so long, they experienced it as a very, very long amount of time. By the way, the way the characters are constructed in the Megillah really, I think, also mirrors this same idea. Just to give you one example, and the truth is there are examples about this all over, and if you want, I mean, if you go home tonight and you read through the characters with this mindset, what you'll see is, and you know, again, this is a fun exercise for you to do, if you go home, think about what your experience is of each character, right? What does Megillah tell us about each character, and what is your reaction to them? And what you'll see is, it's very fascinating, is that your reaction to the characters is very much what the people inside the Megillah reacted to them. So just by way of example, again, if you look, if we think about the different characters, right, in the Megillah, and I'm just going to give you one example of Ahasuerus today because he's sort of an easy one to describe. The Megillah, we think of Ahasuerus and we think, he was so stupid, he was so dumb. Ahasuerus wasn't dumb. Right? Ahasuerus was one of the most powerful people in the world. He was by no means dumb. Right? What Ahasuerus was malleable. Right? If we think about it, all the other characters in the Megillah, right, have private thoughts. Right? For example, right, if you look in... if we look even at the parak that we just read, right? Look back a page. I apologize. In parak Dalid, right? It says Mordechai yada et kol asher naasa, vayikra Mordechai et begadav, vayilbash sak ba'ether, vayitzei b'toch ha'ir, vayizak ze'aka gzola u'mara. The Megillah doesn't tell us Mordechai was sad. The Megillah doesn't tell us he was anxious. The Megillah doesn't say maybe he was feeling guilty because he was one that sort of inspired Haman's wrath. It doesn't tell us anything. And the reader, we have to sort of speculate. We have to try to figure out what exactly Mordechai is feeling at this point. Right? Same thing with Esther. At the end, if you turn the page, right, the very end of her argument her discussion with Mordechai in Pasuk Tet Zayin, right, she gives him this plan and she says, Mordechai, go do what you have to do, make sure everyone is fasting for me. And the end of the second line, she says, V'chasher avaditi avaditi. And when I die, I die. Or when I'm lost, I am lost. And it doesn't say Esther was freaking out. It doesn't say she was scared to death, which she was. Right? The reader has to sort of infer that from the text. Ahasuerus is very different. And by the way, even Haman has private thoughts. Haman, on the way home from the party, right? Haman broods. Haman is angered by Mordechai, which is what we sort of read from his words. And Haman is fantasizing about his power and what's going to happen to him when he's, you know, exalted to be the next in line for the king. And even Haman has private thoughts. The only person in the entire Megillah that has no private thoughts, that we never have to work to figure out what he's feeling, is Ahasuerus. If you look in the source number 6, it says, "Vatima'in hamalka vashti lavo bidvar hamelech asher biyad hasarisim vayiktzof hamelech mod hamato ba'arabo." Right? Automatically, what do we see? He's angry, and the fury is burning inside of him. Next couple of psukim later, when they decide what they should do about, you know, getting rid of Vashti and having a beauty contest. Just getting rid of Vashti at this point. Vayitav hadavar b'nei hamelech hasarim. Things are great in his eyes. Next parak, we're talking about the issue of, right, when they're about to find Esther, have this beauty contest. Achar hadvarim ha'ila kishok hamat ha'melech, once his fury had subsided a little bit. Right, we're given a blow-by-blow exactly how Ahasuerus is feeling at every point throughout the Megillah. Okay? If you think about it, every major decision, and again, if you read through the Megillah, again, think about this, it becomes so clear. Every major thing that happens in the Megillah, from beginning to end, happened as a result of someone around Ahasuerus manipulating him. Ahasuerus makes no decisions of his own, okay? And yet every single turning point in the Megillah, every major thing that happens, it comes as a result of Ahasuerus sort of abdicating power, relegating his powers to someone else, passing his ring to Haman, passing his ring to Mordechai, right? He sort of defers to others to make any major decisions for him, right? And so as readers, we might wonder, well, how is this powerful man so easily manipulated? Right? And it's clear that he's being manipulated because we see his officers waiting for just the right time. But if we experience Ahasuerus the way that the Megillah wants us to experience him, it's very clear. He's easily manipulated because he's constantly exposed. because no one ever has to work hard to figure out what he's stealing. No one ever has to wonder, is now a good time to ask it, or should I ask it later? Because you know exactly how he's feeling at every single point in the Megillah, as did the people around him, both his office, the Persian officers, as well as Esther and Mordechai. And so again, we as readers are experiencing Ahasuerus exactly like his contemporaries. And so it clarifies for us almost the experience of the people around him. The most profound way that I think this concept manifests in the Megillah is in the issue of, and you know, just sort of I don't think there's an accurate way of talking about it, the sort of theological orientation of the Megillah. And just to clarify, clearly the Megillah is part of the canon, and so the existence of God is taken as a given. That's never questioned, right? We're working under that assumption. But what we find if we look at all these sort of religious elements in the Megillah, they're sort of couched in these very ambiguous terms. If we look, for example, back a page, and I apologize because the way it was photocopied, I'm going to have you flipping back and forth a little. If we look back again, this sort of climactic point in the Megillah, we see a bunch of phrases that we might interpret as having to do with God, right? And just one thing I'm going to ask you to do. I know we all grew up with the understanding, if I ask anyone in the room, is God in the Megillah, everyone's going to have the same answer, yes, but he's hidden. And that's absolutely true, and that's Chazal's way, that's sort of, you know, Chazal's approach, and that's absolutely correct. But I'm going to ask you to sort of shelve that just for a little bit, because we're going to come at the same issue maybe from a slightly different angle. So what we see is, if we look again back in Perek Dalet, Mordechai yadat kol asher na'asa, vayikra Mordechai begadah, vayalbash sak va'efer, vayitzi b'toch ha'ir, vayizak z'aka gedola umara. Any reader of Tanakh hears the word za'aka automatically associated with tefillah, because that is a word that is often associated with tefillah. And in fact, Hashem says at different points in Tanakh, right, he says about the sort of vulnerables in society, that when they call out to him and it uses the word za'aka, Hashem will be compelled to answer. Okay? But, right, the Megillah doesn't say he was screaming to Hashem. Okay? Look a little bit further down, right? So too, the Jews are fasting. It says in Pasuk Gimel, Ubechol medina u'medina, makom asher dvar hamelech v'dato magia, eval dadol la'yehudim, v'tzom u'bechi u'mispeid, sak v'efer yutza la'rabim. Again, we imagine Jews to be fasting, and the same goes for Esther when she says on the next page in Pasuk Tzayin, Lech kenoset kol hayudim hanimtzim b'shushan, v'tzumu alai, v'al tohu v'al tishu shosha yamim laila v'yom gam ani, v'narotai atzum chin, v'chol avo el amel v'asher lo kedat v'asher avadzi avadzi. As readers of Tanakh, right, what would they be fasting for if not hoping for some sort of, you know, external reaction? Right? People don't just fast. You could argue maybe Mordechai was just, you know, putting on sack paper and screaming, and that was his emotional reaction. An emotional reaction to something is not to fast. When you fast, and we know from Tanakh, when we fast, it's because we are trying to elicit a response from Hashem. Okay? And so when we're looking at these, so can we imagine Hashem is there? Right? We imagine that Hashem is present, and yet Hashem's absence is also very powerful, because the pasuk doesn't say Hashem. And Esther doesn't say, go and daven to Hashem, right? And so what the reader is struck by is sort of this question, well, is Hashem there or is he not? Right? The Megillah doesn't ignore the topic of Hashem totally. It doesn't just say Esther put on sack v'efer and she cried for a few days. It specifically uses words, right, that we associate with these religious sort of elements, right? And yet it doesn't say it. And so Hashem's absence is almost as powerful as Hashem's presence. And by the way, when I say presence, again, to clarify, I'm not speaking of the existence of God. I'm speaking of presence in terms of his sort of very palpable presence, meaning is God going to really be orchestrating the events? Right? And so we as readers are looking at these psukim, and we're looking throughout the Megillah whenever we see elements like this, and we ourselves are confused. Well, is this Hashem orchestrating events? Or is it just coincidence, right? And aren't the two really one and the same? Or maybe are the two mutually exclusive? And we don't know what to do with this ambiguity. We ourselves are not really 100% sure. Right? Once again, and actually I read a very beautiful, there's a book by Michael Fox, and he wrote a very, very beautiful, he gave an example. He says, when you read Megillat Esther, it's almost like one of those optical illusion pages, right? Where you look at it and you could see the old lady or you could see the young girl. Right? And depending on when you're looking at it, or the angle that you're looking at, or whether how your gaze is fixed on it, and the viewer really could choose to fix their gaze on one of the pictures, it's constantly shifting back and forth. And when you're seeing one, you're convinced you're seeing that, and then when you see the other, you're convinced that's the only picture on the page. Right? And Megillat Esther is very much like that, he says. We're looking through the Megillah, and there are times where we could say, well, of course, how else did Esther end up in the palace? But then we could read it a different time and say, well, she ended up there because she was the most beautiful, and Ahasuerus loved her the most. And so we as readers don't know what to do with this. Again, I think this speaks very, very powerfully to the experience of the Jews, specifically in Persia, but really from Persia and on. Okay? I think if we take a look at the Jews under the Persian Empire, Mordechai, Esther, they had a very, very different reality than any other Jew aside, and I'm going to exclude Sefer Daniel because that's sort of one the other book of Galut. Every Jewish community, every hero, every person we've ever heard about in Tanakh up until now, right? Clearly not just believed in God, but ultimately, and this goes for the whole Jewish community, believed that when push comes to shove, God will come in with a miracle and save us and vanquish our enemies. And really, they had reason to believe that, because that is really what they had seen time and time again. And yes, Jews messed up, and Jews were punished on small scales, but until Churban Bayit, the Jews had this almost childlike innocence. We had this sense of security that no matter what happens, God will come in and miraculously make everything okay. In 597, about 120 or anywhere between 120 and 150 years before Purim, something happened. Right? And Churban Bayit wasn't just, we didn't just lose the Beit HaMikdash. What the Jews lost was that security, was that notion that no matter what happens, God will take care of things. And so the Jews in Persia, Mordechai, Esther, as much as they believed in God, right, they also understood the concept of Galut. If you look at the last source on that page, right, the famous Gemara says, source number 9, it says, Esther min HaTorah minayin, right? Where do we get this name Esther, right? It says, from Dvarim Lamed Alifa, Nocher Hasfer Astira Panai. So Chazal are saying where we get this name Esther, and it's a cute pun, it's a cute play on words. Oh, from the words, Haser Asir Epanai, in Sefer Dvarim, when Hashem is giving the Tochacha, and he says very clearly to Am Yisrael, there's going to be this concept called Galut. And in Galut, I am going to hide my face from you, which means I am not going to be looking as carefully, right? I am not necessarily going to be sort of acting in this overt manner, and you are not going to recognize me. It's going to be more difficult to see you. And so Mordechai and Esther, much like the Jews, I think for the first time in Jewish history, were experiencing something that we in 2008 are almost sort of used to in a way, as unfortunate as that is. But they were experiencing it for the first time. And I think that the Megillah is really validating that experience, validating that notion that, of course, we believe in God, but we believe in God, and we believe in the, by definition, because we believe in God, we believe in the possibility of a miracle, but we can't rely on that miracle. Right? We can't count on it the way we have in generations past. And so if we look at the conversation between Mordechai and Esther, I think it's so telling and I think so emotional, really. If we look, for example, when Esther is scared, right? She says to Pasuk Yud, back on page 5, again, I apologize for the flipping. Source 5, Pasuk Yud, right? Mordechai basically says, Haman has hatched this plan and we have no other choice, you have to go in. And Esther says to him, Batome Esther lahatach batitzaveihu el Mordechai, kol avdei hamelech v'am medinot hamelech yodim, asher kol ish v'isha asher yavo el hamelech el hachatzar hapnimit, asher lo yikare achatato lahamit levad me'asher yoshit lo hamelech et shervit hazahav v'chaya. Right? She basically says, V'ani lo nikriti lavo el hamelech zesh loshim yon. Mordechai, I am scared. Right? Mordechai, I'm scared to go in. And we know Josephus describes that the throne of Ahasuerus was surrounded by these men literally with axes. It wasn't the king gets angry and says, oh, now I'm going to kill you. The axes would come down. If the scepter was not pointed at you and you walked in, you were killed on the spot. And so Esther says to Mordechai, Mordechai, I am scared. Right? But Mordechai can't answer her the way that we've seen leaders in the past answer. And I brought Yirmiyahu as an example, but we see this with all our leaders. We see with Moshe in the Midbar. We see this with Yishayahu. We see this right with Barak. We see so many of our leaders scared. And for example, if again, turn the page, source 8. Right, Yirmiyahu, Hashem appears to Yirmiyahu, right? This is in the century, right, the generation of the Churban, and so it's really not that long before the experience of Purim, and yet the reality is such a totally different reality. Hashem appears to Yirmiyahu, and he says, Yirmiyahu, b'tarem etzarcha b'vet ani yedatzicha, basically, you have been chosen before you were even born, right? And he says, basically, I want you to be a Navi. And Pasuk Vav, Yirmiyahu responds, Da'omar, Aha Hashem Elokim, Hine lo yadati davar kinar hanochi. Hashem, but I'm so young, I'm so inexperienced. Vayomer Hashem Eli, right? And what does Hashem say to this fear, to this ambivalence? Al tomar nar hanochi, ki al kol go asher ashachachati leich, vet kol asher atabeka tidaber. Yirmiyahu, don't be scared, I'll be with you. Al tira mipnehem, ki itcha ami lahatzilcha ne'um Hashem. But Hashem told Yirmiyahu 150, 160 years prior to this, Mordechai couldn't assure Esther. He couldn't say that to her because as Jews and Galuts, we don't have that, again, that same sense of security. But Mordechai talks to her about something else. And if you look back inside, first page, Mordechai says to her, Pasuk Yudalit, it's at the very bottom of that source number 5, he says to her, Ki im hacharish tacharishi ba'et hazot, revach v'hatzala ya'amud la'yehudim mimakom acher, ve'at ubeit avich tovedu, umi yodea im la'et kazot higat la'malchut. Mordechai says very clearly to Esther, Esther, I believe in the continuity of the Jewish people. I believe that the Jewish people will exist and will continue to thrive and will continue to be for all time because that is a promise that Hashem made to us. Right? Mordechai couldn't say to her, Esther, you'll be fine. What he had to say to her, and what I think he says to her, and it's in a very, very real way, is the reality of Galut is that we don't have that. Right? We don't have that sort of confidence. We don't have that 100% sense of security. What we do have is each other. What we have is ourselves. And Esther, you are in a place where you can determine the outcome, or you could at least try to determine the outcome. Right? And Mordechai calls her to the plate. And Mordechai says, in Galut, all we have really to rely on is ourselves and is each other. And so we have to take advantage of those points where we are in places in which we can do something for the Jewish community. And if you look, right, we know that, in fact, Esther does step up to the plate. Right? Scared as she does step up. And ultimately, she does bring this sort of salvation to the Jewish people. Right? And the reaction of the Jewish people, if you look back, again, I apologize. At the first source, Perek Tet, the very first place that we looked, right, we see that what was the response of the Jewish people? We don't see them falling down and thanking God. Again, it might be implied because we know that in Judaism, Mishteh is associated with Seudat Mitzvah, but it's not written explicitly. We don't see the Jews falling down and thanking God for their salvation. What do we see them doing? We see them having in that last pasuk, Yemei Mishteh, Visimcha, Umishloach Manot Ish Lireehu, Umatanot Levyonim. It's not like we first thought they were having parties like we see the Persians having these drinking parties and these just sort of celebrations because they were freed. Almost the immediate reaction of the Jews, when the Jews saw the heroism that Mordechai and Esther modeled, they weren't just going out and having parties and getting drunk. They instantaneously, the parties were almost a manifestation of them reaching out to each other and sharing Mishloach Manot Ish L'Re'ehu and making sure that the aniyim in the community were taken care of and that there weren't poor people who didn't have what to eat that day. Right? And so their almost emotional reaction to this heroism was to reach out to each other. Because Mordechai and Esther made very clear to them that in Galut, that is what we have. And that is what not just what we have and not just what we have to rely on, but what we have to celebrate. I think that if we go back now, and by the way, just as a side note, because this is something that used to bother me until I read the Pesukim carefully, because the initial question I asked is how, you know, we're not worried about the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. If you look inside, read carefully tonight when you go home, the Megillah, the edict that Haman makes is not just for the Jews in Shushan, it includes all the Jews throughout the provinces. And so when that edict was not revoked, because they couldn't revoke it, but when the second edict of Mordechai was sent out, the Jews in Eretz Yisrael were saved as well. Okay, so it's just something to, I think, again, give us this sense. We think of them as two completely estranged communities. They were really part under, you know, the same empire, the same regime. But if we look back, I think now really our questions are answered. Right? Because we ask, why do we not have a separate mitzvah to evoke those emotions, to sort of conjure up that experience of galut? But if you think about it, that's in fact exactly, and then we ask, why does the Megillah, why is that mandated? Why must we read the Megillah? The two answers are really one and the same. We must read the Megillah because the Megillah is just that. The experience of the Megillah, the reading of the Megillah, is not just hearing a story that we know of. Right? Kriyat HaMegillah, the mitzvah of Megillah, forces a Jew to sit for 40 minutes and experience the myriad of emotions that the Jews in Persia and that the Jews throughout the last 2,500 years of our history have experienced. The enticement, the allure of this new world, of this sort of new and the promising new world, and the sort of strangeness that we feel and that experience that we're a little bit on the outs, but we know that as Jews, in order to survive in this new world that we've been thrust into, we have to sort of navigate and we have to figure out the system and learn to really play and work within that system. And then we have the fear of the threats that come, and ultimately, hopefully, we have that experience of elation when, once again, we are saved. And again, saved because we believe in God and we believe in the promise that He made, which is that we will endure. And so I think, you know, going back even to the third question, why is it that halachically we're mandated to party? We're not mandated to party. But if we listen carefully, I think, to the Megillah, and the Megillah sort of elicits the response that it's intended to elicit, we're not forced to go out and party. The only thing we can do when we leave Kriyat HaMegillah, when we leave the shul, is go and reach out and celebrate what we have and celebrate ourselves and celebrate each other, right? And celebrate the sort of exquisite potential that the Jewish people have, that they've always proven to have and that they continue to have. And so hopefully, Amir Tashem, if we read Megillat Esther as carefully as we're really supposed to, this should be the last time that we read Megillat Esther with the reality of Galut as it is, and hopefully the next time you read it, that reality and that experience of Galut should be a distant memory.